Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
One of my great joys is traveling in our great brotherhood, meeting gospel preachers, working with them in lectureships and meetings such as this. One discouraging aspect of that is that I find many of these young preachers and older preachers who, in my opinion, are not studying much anymore, if indeed they ever did. Tony Lawrence is an exception to that. He and I had some rather lengthy discussions last year when I was here on the lectureship, and I am very much impressed by his dedication to study scholarship. The church absolutely must have young men and older men who are willing to investigate and then to speak out on the issues that we face, and not just the moral, but spiritual as well. So I'm delighted to be invited back and to be associated with you in this effort. When I was graduated from Freed Hardeman in 1946, my first congregation was Niles, Michigan, which is like throwing a baby to the wolves because it was a very difficult work. But one of the people that I met was Brother Richard Bonner, who led our prayer tonight. Richard was about 16 years of age. He pestered me to death during the time that I stayed. We would go to bed and we slept together. And he would say, "Now, what does this verse mean? What do you think Paul had in mind here?" And at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, I would say, "Richard, now how about let's quitting tonight and start again tomorrow?" But that kind of attitude, that dedication to study, has characterized Richard all of these years. And even though I have 8 brothers in the flesh, 7, 8 of us Claiborne boys, not many of them are any closer to me than Richard Bonner. So it's delightful tonight to spend these few hours with him. He and his lovely wife picked me up at the airport, and I have enjoyed immensely renewing this long, long acquaintance with Richard. The topic that I have been assigned is an extremely broad one. It would take at least a dozen lectures to deal with many facets of abortion. In fact, in just a moment, I want to read a list of topics that I have used on my radio program and some that I am getting ready to use, all of them relating to abortion. But I would like to begin tonight by asking you to turn to Psalm 8, and I shall read it. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. When I consider thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. And the word angel here in Hebrew is Elohim. Other places translated God or gods. Thou hast made him a little lower than God, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and all the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passes through the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. I want you to look carefully, if you will, at verse 4, because that is one of the key issues, whether we're dealing with suicide, euthanasia, infanticide, or abortion. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the Son of Man that thou dost visit him. What is a human being? Of how much value is he or should he be? The crucial issue in the matter of abortion is not how the abortion is done, although there are many people, and I include myself among them, who are very upset about that. To have a little child chopped up in pieces and sucked out by vacuum as if he were no more than the dirt, to me is very disconcerting. But that really is not the main issue. If the baby in his mother's body is just a mass of protoplasm, it does not matter how the abortion is performed. Some babies are poisoned by saline solution, salt. In their mother's bodies, they turn about the color of cooked apples. And then the mother begins to have contractions, and she expels the baby. The baby dies a horrible death in its mother's body. But that really is not the issue. It is an issue, but not the issue. The issue is how much value we are in the sight of Almighty God. As one young theologian has expressed it, am I my brother's? Am I my neighbor? He is the baby, my neighbor. In other words, is the child in his mother's womb my neighbor? If he is my neighbor, then you know how I am to treat him. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. In recent years, Ellen Goodman, and you may have seen her name in various newspapers, has written an article. In fact, she calls it something of this nature, the major issue in abortion. And she says it is the pain that the child has to suffer. She is a feminist, which means that most of what she writes you cannot trust anyway, but she is dead wrong about what the main issue is. If the child is no more than a mass of protoplasm, just cells, and incidentally, Joseph Fletcher called the baby in his mother's womb a disease, a venereal disease. And if that's all the baby is, then the pain it endures may be an issue, but it is not the issue. If you were to go to your doctor, and he said to you, you have cancer of your leg. The only way your leg can be saved is to amputate it. There will be enormous pain. Probably. Not in the process, because you would be asleep, but as you recover. But you gladly give up a leg or an arm or other members of your body so that the rest of your body can survive. Pain is not the issue. Not really the issue, but what we are in God's sight and ought to be in the sight of good men is the issue. The value of each human being. There are many passages I wish we had time to examine tonight. Let me suggest a few. And then if you will, go home and read these and think of abortion as you read them. Psalm 139 deals with the wonder and the grandeur of the human body. There is a statement made in verses 13 and 14 which says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. There is a new book written by Dr. Paul Brand, who is a specialist with leprosy, Hansen's disease, and he calls it fearfully and wonderfully made. The human body is a marvel. Science has done wonders in our generation, but they cannot reproduce the human body. But the human body pales into insignificance compared to the mind of human beings. We are fearfully and wonderfully made in the same context. The inspired writer says that God knows us before we are formed. From the moment of conception, God knows who we are and He values us. Perhaps no passage makes that plainer than statements made in Jeremiah 1 with regard to Jeremiah. A few months ago on radio, In fact, the week before Christmas, I raised a question with regard to Jesus Christ. What was Christ before he was born? Oh, I know he was a baby. Although the abortionists do not like for us to use that term, they say that we prejudice the case when we talk about a baby or a child in its mother's womb. That is the way abortionists talked 25 years ago, before the Doe and the Roe decisions. If you went to a doctor and told him you were pregnant and explained to him that you wanted to keep what was inside your body, he would end up calling it a baby. But if you said, I have no interest in it, he would call it a thing or a piece of protoplasm. And this kind of discussion, this kind of language is deceptive, and intentionally so. Recently, a medical doctor in Memphis said that before the child is born, he is not human. Another doctor responded by saying, in effect, there is no doctor on the face of God's earth who does not know better than that. All doctors know that every child at the moment of conception is a human baby, a human embryo. Not all doctors agree that the embryo or the fetus or whatever the stage is ought to be preserved. But they know that what is conceived of a human father and a human mother is a human baby. Now for just a minute, I want to outline how we can attack, in fact, how we must attack this problem that we face. And I'll give you more information on it in just a moment. These are some sermons that I have either preached on radio or in the pulpit, or delivered lectures at Fried Hartman, or am planning to in the very near future. Let me just go down this list very briefly. And we'll talk about this one after a while. Does abortion lead to infanticide? I want you to think seriously about that, because it is a major area, and I'll show you in just a few minutes that it does and has. Number two, pro-choice. You hear that term thrown about so much. Certain people are pro-choice. No, they are not. They are pro-death. Pro-choice, when it comes to choosing between a human being's living and dying, pro-choice means pro-death. The third topic, what if Jesus had been aborted? And incidentally, in talking about Jesus, are you aware of the fact that the term, the Greek word, brephos, which is used of Jesus in his mother's womb, is also the term that was used after he was born? From God's side, there is a continuum from the day that baby is conceived until he dies. The crucial issue in the abortion controversy, and I mentioned that a while ago, abortion and quality of life. I hear people say, this child will be born with spina bifida, or with Down syndrome, or with no brain. This is a condition called anencephaly. So he cannot have quality life. Would you like to define for me what quality life means? I'll give you an illustration in a moment. Abortion and child abuse. I'm concerned, as I know you are, about the enormous number of children in our country that are being beaten and burned and even killed. One child over near Dixon, Tennessee, was placed in an oven and baked by its own mother. And I know children that have been burned and their legs broken and their heads injured in such a fashion that they were permanently disabled mentally. But what is a greater form of child abuse than killing a child? Abortion. I have absolutely no doubt, though I cannot absolutely establish this, that there is a connection between the increase in the number of abortions and the increase in the number of children that are abused. If a mother can kill her baby, and she can, one day before it is born, why can she not do it one day after it is born? and the attitude that would allow a mother to take her child's life in her body, it seems to me, would spill over into other actions with her children. I believe there is a connection between abortion and child abuse. Abortion and adoption. Why are we not giving up the babies that we do not want? And these are being born by the hundreds of thousands, and they have for hundreds of years. Why not give them to couples who desperately want them, who would even be willing to pay for them? And they are paying for them in many cases. I'm getting ready to do a sermon based on the events that transpired at Maryville, Tennessee. And I'm calling the lesson, Are Human Embryos Human? They certainly are not pigs. They're not monkeys. If they're not human embryos, what in the world are they? Abortion and feminism. Is abortion killing? Our abortionist friends do not like to use words like kill and murder. But that really is what goes on in the womb. There is a movement in this country called Rescue Now. Is now the time for rescue? Rescue of those hundreds of thousands of babies that are dying every year in their mother's bodies? The medical profession and abortion. Language and abortion. I indicated a while ago how many of these people misuse deliberately language. When they talk about a child not being a child and just a mass of protoplasm, they know better, and they do it to deceive. The psychological effects of abortion, the physical effects of abortion. Abortion and guilt. I'm sure you have read enough to know that many of those in the pro-choice movement say that women do not feel guilty when they take the lives of these babies in their bodies. I do not believe they're telling the truth. Oh, I suspect there are some women who could abort babies. Are you aware, for example, that the average woman in the Soviet Union has aborted 4 babies? And many have aborted as many as 9 babies. Maybe with the philosophy or the theology that they have been taught, Marxism, materialism, which discounts any kind of spiritual values, maybe this has spilled over on them and they do not care anymore. Although I suspect that's not true in many cases. But I do not believe any normal woman, any woman who has been brought up to respect motherhood and babies, can ever take the life of a baby without guilt eating her alive. Let me recommend a book to you. There is a new book called Silent Abortion, Aborted Women, Silent No More. There is an organization, or was, I think they have disbanded and joined other groups, that calls itself WEBA, W-E-B-A. That means Women Exploited by Abortion. Throughout this book of about 400 pages, there are numerous examples of women who have aborted their babies because they were feminists, women's liberationists, and who today feel guilty, and they are guilty because they took their babies' lives. I'm aware that many people in our society, oddly enough, including many theologians, who discount the importance of guilt. Many psychologists say that guilt should never be used, and it needs to be forgotten. Let me give you one example. Dr. Albert Ellis is a psychologist. He has organized a new approach to counseling that he calls rational emotive therapy. Dr. Ellis says in his book, Sex and the Liberated Man, that nobody should ever feel guilty about anything he or she does. You think about that for a moment. Nobody should ever feel guilty about anything he or she does. If that strikes you as being rather foolish, and if it does not, I'm concerned about you, then remember that Dr. Ellis is a humanist. He signed Humanist Manifesto number 3 in 1972, and his philosophy is certainly consistent with what he says about guilt. In fact, Dr. Ellis says, you came into the world for no special reason. And the universe does not care whether you live or die, achieve great pain or pleasure. You are here by accident. There is no God. There is no purpose. No goal in life. You are no more than an animal. And so why should you feel guilty? I'm aware that preachers sometimes, and parents, and even teachers, make people feel guilty when they are not. That is false guilt, and it is destructive. But my friends, when we sin against God Almighty, and against our fellow men, and feel guilty about it, we have a right to. We are guilty. When you take the life of a child in his mother's body, whether you are a nurse or a doctor or a boyfriend or a husband or the woman herself, you are guilty. Guilty before God and guilty before right-thinking people. I followed my sermon on radio on abortion and guilt with a sermon on abortion and forgiveness. And I made these observations. There probably are young women, perhaps even older women, in my audience today that have had an abortion. Or you may be a father who encouraged your wife to have an abortion, or your daughter, or a boyfriend who encouraged it. Or you may be the doctor who did it. And I do not want to add to your guilt. You are guilty. You are guilty of violating the very highest principle of God's truth. Thou shalt not murder. But I have good news for you. Through the blood of Jesus Christ and your obedience to the gospel, even the taking of the life of an innocent baby can be forgiven. What I am offering you today and what I am offering you tonight is Jesus Christ and the gospel that cleanses all men and all women from all sin. Abortion, as you know, is probably the most controversial issue in the last 20 or 25 years. In fact, I do not know of any issues in our history that have been more controversial except slavery and perhaps the Vietnam War. But abortion touches everybody, not just the people who are in war or who oppose war. It touches everybody. In 1973, our United States Supreme Court made it legal for a woman to kill her baby in her body any time from the day it is conceived until the day that it is born. I'm aware that many of the pro-abortionists say, no, that's not true. You can kill it in the first 3 months, but not after that. That's not true. They simply are wrong, and they know it. Now, there are some restrictions. In the last trimester, for example, the last 3 months, a woman has to have some reason, either her physical body or her mental condition, have to determine that she will be sick if she does not have an abortion. But you can get doctors to say that she might commit suicide. You can hire a psychiatrist to say whatever you want him to say. And I don't mean that to be unkind to psychiatrists, but you know it's true. I am convinced that many of them, as we used to say over in Sumner County, are anybody's dog that'll hunt with them. You just pay the price, and they will say, if this woman does not get an abortion, she might commit suicide. The first place, he does not know that. And pregnant women commit suicide far less than women who are not pregnant. But you can take the life of your baby from the day it is conceived until the day it is delivered. And 1,600,000 women in the United States choose that option every year. That means between 1973 and 1990, about 25 million babies have been slaughtered by their own mothers. 25 million. About 50 million to 75 million are killed worldwide. The city of Louisville, Kentucky kills 10,000 babies every year. Is that about the number of the people who live in McMinnville? That 10,000? The most dangerous place on the face of God's earth for a baby is in his mother's body. That, dear friend, is very, very distressing. It ought to cause every one of us to stand up and do something about the abortion holocaust that is occurring in our nation. I want to make an argument tonight. What am I supposed to be through? About 8? One argument. I think I have read, and I don't say this boastfully, all the arguments that the abortionists make. Most of them are childish. All of them are illogical. But I want to make one argument in response to what they say. Let me state it very simply, and then we will explain it, make an application of it. Whatever argument can be offered for abortion, and I think I've read all of them, can also be offered for infanticide and euthanasia. Let me repeat it. Whatever argument the pro-abortionists use to justify taking the life of a baby in his mother's womb can also be used for killing that baby once he is born, or killing old people when they have reached that stage in life that they are permanently comatose, when they no longer are productive, and when they cost us thousands and thousands of dollars a year to keep them in nursing homes or hospitals or in our private homes. You may not use the words infanticide and euthanasia on a regular basis, although if you think about them, I think you'll understand what they mean. The word infanticide simply means killing babies after they are born. But nobody would do that, would they? Take the life of a little baby after it is born, after you can hold it in your arms? Actually, infanticide has been practiced worldwide since the beginning of history. Go back and read about ancient Egypt or Babylon or the Medes and the Persians. All of these nations, ancient China, have practiced infanticide. The truth is, modern China practices infanticide more than any other country in the world. The Chinese are not permitted by law to have more than one child. If a second child is born, the taxes are so exorbitant that the people cannot live. If they have a little girl and they want a little boy, and the boy is born the second time and they cannot have both, they kill the little girl. It is happening by the thousands and thousands in modern China. In ancient Greece, infanticide was recommended, oddly enough, by the most influential philosopher who ever lived, Plato. Both Plato and Aristotle said that babies who are born to mothers beyond 40 ought either to be aborted or killed once they are born, because there is a greater danger of various kinds of physical and mental abnormalities. Besides, abortion and euthanasia and infanticide ought to be used to control the population. In ancient Rome, little girls were considered to be inappropriate because they did not make good soldiers. The Caesars wanted boys so they could train them up to be soldiers. So the little girls that were not wanted were simply taken out to the mountainside or the caves of the forest, where they were left to die from starvation or to be devoured by the wild animals, or to be picked up by men who operated houses of prostitution and turned into prostitutes when they reached the age of 6 or 8 or 10. But now Babylon and Egypt and China and Rome and Greece are pagan civilizations, although the Greeks would have objected to that characterization, but they were. These are pagan nations. Oh, they claim to have gods, but they became like their gods, as Paul teaches in Romans 1. Heathen nations, pagan nations. But we take great pride in claiming that the United States is a Christian nation. It really is not. It never has been. Although it was founded on Christian principles. Many of our forefathers, Washington, Madison, were men who believed in God, who believed in applying the Scriptures to their lives and to the government, which our modern Supreme Court seems to ignore. But we are not a Christian nation. But there are hundreds of thousands of people who claim they belong to Jesus Christ. They attend churches. So we as a Christian nation would never, under any circumstances, allow the taking of the lives of little babies once they are born. I hope you do not think that. Because if you do, it means that you're not keeping up. Your eyes are not open. You're not reading your newspapers and magazines and listening to television and radio. About 5 years ago, a veterinarian, a doctor from Harvey, Illinois, walked into the nursery of the hospital and saw his newborn son for the very first time. As he looked down on the face and the body of that little boy, he noticed severe abnormalities. He had a cleft palate. He suffered from a condition known as clenched fists, which can be corrected surgically. He had other problems. The doctor reached down into that crib and took that little boy and beat his brains out on the floor of the hospital in Harvey, Illinois. They arrested this doctor. They had a trial. His neighbors came together and they said, "He's a gentle and kind and loving man." If a neighbor has a sick pet, the doctor will sit up with him all night to save that pet. But he killed his son. He killed his own son. At the end of the trial, the judge turned him loose because he said, "We do not have a law in Illinois that forbids that kind of activity." No law in Illinois that forbids murder? We have one in Tennessee. I did not know there was a state in the Union that did not have a law against murder. I talked to Dan Reitinger a while ago. I held a meeting when Dan was preaching in Bloomington, Indiana. And as I told him, Bloomington's kind of the heart of America. These are great people. So it was very disturbing to me to learn what happened in Bloomington. If it had been New Orleans or New York or San Francisco, I would not have been surprised. A school teacher and his wife had a son. The school teacher had been reading about Down syndrome children. He decided, for some reason, that Down syndrome children cannot have quality life. So they decided that this little boy who needed surgery would not have surgery. He had a condition known as esophageal atresia, which means at the end of the esophagus there is a sac and the food cannot pass into the stomach. Had they fed the child orally, the food would have exited either side of the esophagus and he would have died of pneumonia. The doctor said, "We can correct this problem. It is a severe problem, but about 95% of the children who have this surgery survive. We can help your boy." The parents said, "No, there will be no surgery." He was a Down syndrome child, and they decided that Down syndrome children could not have quality life and did not deserve to live. The people at the hospital contested that decision. They went to the local district attorney and asked him to investigate. He did. He called for the local judge. They had a trial, they had a hearing in one of the rooms at the hospital. The judge said, "These parents can do whatever they choose." Now, we're not talking about abortion. We're talking about a baby that's already born. When it hit the news national news. And I remember hearing it on ABC or CBS and reading it in the papers. There were calls from all over the United States, at least 12 couples called and said, "You give us the little boy. We will pay for the surgery and we'll rear this little boy as our own." The parents said no. George Will, who has a Down syndrome son, said they wanted him dead. His only problem was that he was born crippled. What is almost beyond my understanding, they let him starve to death. Now, if a child does not deserve to live, why didn't they shoot him? I know that's cruel, but is it as cruel as starving a child? Why didn't they give him a shot of morphine? Do you know what starving is? I know what we say, we men, when we get home and the wife is 5 minutes late for lunch. I'm starving to death. But we're really not. 2 days before this little boy died, he would open his mouth to cry, but he could not cry because there was no moisture. One nurse who waited on him left because she said, "I am not committing infanticide." The nurse who stayed wishes she had never. She wrote an article recently and she said, "I'll never go through it again." Hours before baby Doe died, blood trickled from his little mouth, and he died a horrible death. Now, that's not ancient China. That's Bloomington, Indiana. I told Richard and his wife driving over tonight that I have a little dog in my house. I've always been a no-dog man. When my boys got one back when they were growing up, and Molly always kept them one, I paid no attention to him. None. Didn't want him around. Didn't want him touching me. I didn't want to touch him. You ought to see this 64-year-old man with a dog now. I mean, I am so attached to that little fellow that you would not believe it. My sons think their father's getting senile. 2 or 3 years ago, Molly and I had a picture made, maybe 4 or 5. Pepe was sitting on my lap and Molly sitting by me on the couch. We sent this to our friends and to the boys, and one of my boys called and said, "You never did that for me." When we got him, Molly said, "Now, he's not to be in the room where we eat." Fine with me. I didn't want him in the first place. Would you like to guess where he eats? Right by my plate. Our doctor said, "Now, don't feed him table scraps." I don't feed him table scraps. I feed him steak. He doesn't get any scraps. Maybe it is senility. I'm not what sure. But I tell you this, if he were to get hurt and have to be put to sleep, I would really hurt. When he gets sick now, I worry about him. I can't imagine starving that dog. I really cannot. I'm not a cat lover, but I couldn't starve a cat. But we're not talking about animals. We're talking about babies. Little babies. Oh, I know he had Down syndrome, but I've got lots of friends that are Down syndrome. I held a meeting at a little town in Missouri this spring. We took about 10 of our college kids for a campaign. Little town of Ava, Missouri. The night I arrived on Saturday night late, they were all in the building having a singing with our young people. I noticed a rather heavy lady get up and start toward me, and I wondered, what have I done to deserve this? And she came back and threw her arms around my neck and welcomed me to Ava, Missouri. Nobody else did. She was a Down syndrome young woman. Down syndrome children don't deserve to live. Now, if we can kill a baby who is going to be Down syndrome, and that can be determined by amniocentesis and by other tests, why can't we kill the child after it's born? I still haven't made the argument. What about euthanasia? The word euthanasia literally means good death. The Greek word eu meaning good or well, depending on the context, and thanatos meaning death. But today, in the United States and in England, it means mercy killing. You probably looked at your morning paper today, the Tennessean or the Banner, and saw that Roswell Gilbert from Florida had been released from prison after spending 5 years in prison for shooting his wife. Mrs. Gilbert had Alzheimer's disease. She was lying on the couch. Mr. Gilbert went in with a 9mm German Luger and pumped 2 bullets into her body and killed her. They gave him 25 years, but he's out in 5. But now euthanasia, whatever you want to call it, if you can dress it up and call it good death or call it mercy killing, it's still killing. And again, it has been practiced for years and years. The Indians in America practice rather widely. The Eskimos do. When a man gets old or a woman gets old, non-productive, sickly, they put him or her on an ice floe and go out into the ocean and perish. The Nazi Holocaust, all of us know about, the 6 million Jews that were killed, maybe 20 million others, including Czechs and Poles and communists and homosexuals. They killed anybody they did not like. But what many people in America do not know, because we have not been informed, they kill their own people. They started abortion about 1909. Now, they would not allow abortion among the Nordics. That is, the people that they considered to be the master race. But they encouraged it among Jews and encouraged it everywhere else except among the Nordics. But they also killed 275,000 of their own old people. Hitler gave the power for doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists to go to nursing homes, private homes, hospitals, to investigate the old people, sickly people, to see whether or not they would ever get well. If these doctors determined after a very cursory examination, maybe a minute or two, that this person would never be well or never be productive, then they would take a geranium and put it on a window ledge outside so that those who were taking these old people would know where to stop. And they'd pick up these old people and tell them, "We're taking you to a nice, warm home where you can be comfortable the rest of your life." They drove as straight as an arrow to the ovens and the gas chambers. And they killed 275,000 of their own old people. Why? Hitler called them useless eaters. They are consuming precious materials that could be used for conquering the world. You think it's possible, even probable, that we may be heading in the same direction? Have you noticed recently that those who favor euthanasia are wanting the doctors to make a choice whether or not a person dies? Doctors? I love doctors. I have a number of very close doctor friends. But I don't want doctors making that kind of decision. They're the ones that made it in Nazi Germany. The psychiatrists, the medical doctors, the psychologists. I don't want them making that kind of decision. But now let's go back to the argument. Whatever justification can be offered for aborting babies can also be offered for killing babies after they're born or for taking the lives of old people who are no longer productive. Let me give you one argument. I've talked about the general argument. Now, what is one of the arguments that's used? Let's talk about money. I'm aware that our public health system may be in very serious difficulty in the next 10 or 15 years. It may already be. If nothing else, AIDS may break us from a standpoint of our Medicare and Medicaid systems. When we reach the year 2000, which is only 10 years away, and have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people dying from AIDS, and each of these patients costing about $140,000 apiece, and much of that on public support, then I think you can see where we are in our public health system. But let's talk about money. if a parent learns that a child will be born Down syndrome, or with spina bifida, or Huntington's chorea, or Tay-Sachs disease, and there are 100 different genetic diseases that can be determined by amniocentesis or other methods. If the parents decide that the child will be handicapped, he knows that it will be enormously expensive. So he goes to his doctor, or she goes to the doctor, and they say, "We cannot afford this child. We have two other children already. We do not make much money, and the child will be expensive." Spina bifida children, for example, have to have surgery after surgery, many times 10 and 15 operations. So the parents say, "We cannot afford it. So we're going to abort this child." When the child is born, they know he has spina bifida. They know he is Down syndrome. They know he is anencephalic with no brain. They know that. So why can't they take the life of the child when he's born? It will be expensive. I would not deny that for a moment. Any child, every child, is expensive. But do we kill the baby in his mother's body because that baby is expensive? If we do, why not kill it after it is born? And old people who go to nursing homes cost their families enormous sums of money. I had a dear friend who died 3 years ago at the wonderful age of 108. I visited her over a period of 6 years. I fell in love with her. One of the most dynamic people I ever met in my life. But I know what she cost her family. One of her sons is in our congregation at Scotts Hill. She cost them about $20,000, $25,000 a year, and over a long, long period. But Grandma Goff was not very productive. All she did the last 2 or 3 years of her life was to lie in a fetal position in a bed, and she weighed about 54 or 5 pounds. Of what value was she? I go to nursing homes to visit old people that do not know where they are. They do not even know that they are. Now, if we can kill the little babies because they're not productive and because they're expensive, why can't we kill Grandma Goff? Last night, at about 9 o'clock, I received a call to come visit a man in a nursing home. He's 103. Delightful person. He's had many strokes for the last 2 or 3 days, M-I-N-I, as well as many in number. And as I went by his bed, he reached out and grabbed my hand and pulled me down close. I knew what he wanted. He wanted me to pray for him. Why don't we just go shoot Mr. Will? He's costing his family. He's costing you. Because through our taxes, we support many of these old people. Let me close with a story very close to my heart. A number of years ago, when I worked in the insurance business in Georgia, I had a young woman, a young Christian woman, who was one of our secretaries. I had not seen her in several years. She called me early one morning and said, "Brother Claiborne, I need for you to come to the hospital." She was crying. I dropped whatever I was doing and rushed to the hospital. When I entered the front door, she met me and she said, "They're trying to take my baby away from me." And I said, "Who's trying to take your baby?" And she said, "The doctors and the hospital people." "Why?" "Well, he's Down syndrome. And the doctor said, you need to put him away and forget him." Forget your own flesh and blood? They wanted her to send this baby to Grace Memorial Hospital at Augusta, Georgia. And she said, "What do you think I ought to do? He's Down syndrome." They said, "He'll never walk or talk. He will be susceptible to every disease that comes along, and Down syndrome children are. So what do you think I ought to do?" I knew after I talked to her a while, it didn't make any difference what I thought. I knew what she was going to do. She was going to take that baby home. And that's exactly what she did. I did not see Joyce for another 6 years. But then I went to Calhoun, Georgia for a gospel meeting. That morning as I walked in the door, early, nobody else in the building. But after a while, I noticed a little boy at 6 years of age start walking toward me. with his hand outstretched and said, "Brother Claiborne, I'm glad to meet you." I knew who he was. And you can imagine the joy that I received from seeing this little boy. Today he's 21 years old. And he is loved. And he loves. I spoke on this topic or a similar topic in South Carolina recently. One of the elders of the church has a Down syndrome child. He said to me after the meeting, "It's been great to have you for the meeting, but I want you to know especially how I appreciate what you said about Down syndrome children." He said, "David came into our life about 18 years ago, and I thought I knew what love was, but I did not. But I know today, because David has taught us how to love." You want to destroy the Down syndrome children and the old people? Are you aware that you may be doing it? I want to make three suggestions for you. Number one, become informed. Know what's going on. Read your newspaper. Read books. Tony will help you get books. I'll help you get books. Number two, pray for our country, especially for the men and women that lead it. Pray for President Bush. Pray for the new man that has been suggested for the United States Supreme Court. Vote your convictions. Don't vote for Albert Gore because he's a Democrat or for some other man because he's a Republican. Vote for them if and only if they support life. If they do not support life, send them back to the farm. There is a statement in the book of Deuteronomy that I'd like to leave with you tonight. When the Israelites were about to cross the Jordan River, going through the wilderness, getting ready, the Lord began to give instructions through Moses. The whole book of Deuteronomy is full of them. And he said to the people through Moses, "I'm setting before you this day two ways, a way of life, a way of death." And then very tersely, God said through Moses, "Choose life." That's what I'm asking you to do tonight. Choose life.
I know that each and every one of us are deeply moved, at least I hope we are, by the things that Brother Claiborne has had to say. If you do have any questions, if you would, Brother Thurman will get them by. I do want to state some. If you'll hold them up so he can see them if you've got any questions. I do have a sheet here that I'm fixing to give Brother Claiborne. I told him I'd make him a copy yesterday that gives the voting record in 1989 of all of the pro-life issues that came before the Senate and the House of Representatives and how they voted. And you can look and see how our representatives vote. I should have placed this out before today. The polls closed about an hour and 4 minutes ago, and you could have made yourself known. But I think it would be very valuable for each of us to know, as Brother Claiborne suggested. Are there any questions? Must have covered the issue extremely well.
Or they may be embarrassed to ask. Or not know what to ask. I don't mind any question. I'm aware that there are some areas that are not easy for us to make decisions. For example, what about rape and incest? Now, I did not talk about therapeutic abortion, which really means an abortion that is designed to save the life of the mother, not necessarily mental health, but physical health. And there are a few conditions. For example, if a baby is conceived in the fallopian tubes or anywhere outside the womb, then the mother's life is in danger. The fallopian tubes were not designed to house a baby. So when it begins to grow and expand, then the fallopian tubes are going to explode and the mother will bleed to death. So it's not a question of either or in the area of therapeutics. If the abortion is not performed, both will die. If it is performed, the mother can live. But now on incest and rape, the baby is still a baby. And the tragedy is that there are many women who have had abortions because of rape or incest and then spent the rest of their lives grieving. I can understand why a mother might not want the child for her own, but there are a million couples in the United States that would love to have that baby. So these are some areas that are not easy. They're called hard cases. But if we really value life, then I think we can make the right decision. Now, if you have a question, I don't want to press, and I might not have the answer. But I'd be delighted to address any question or comment that anybody might have. Brother. The new law in Pennsylvania is far more restrictive than any other law in the United States. It still allows abortion for rape and incest, and of course to save the life of the mother. I don't know anybody who would vote against saving the life of the mother except Roman Catholics. And I don't mean this to be ugly or hypocritical, but they would not, which is rather odd. Because if a mother has a baby in a womb, and the womb is cancerous, you can remove the cancer. The baby with it, but you can't remove the baby. Now, to me, that's straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. But the Pennsylvania law is a start in the right direction. And of course, you saw a few days ago what they tried to do in Louisiana, and Governor Romer vetoed it. And I hope the voters veto him the next time. And of course, the Webster decision in Missouri is a step in the right direction. But for it all to be straightened out, we just can't chip at it piecemeal. We've got to have Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton overturned. And they can be overturned. After all, the Dred Scott decision was along the same line, the one that said blacks are subhuman, and it's been overturned. The court overturns itself every once in a while. And that's the reason I said pray for them. Don't think it'd do any good to write them, but at least you can address this before the throne of God. But there are a number of excellent suggestions that are being given. There are a number of laws being passed, and let us hope that these will help to save the lives of little babies. Let me mention one other aspect of the financial end of it. We've killed 25 million citizens. What's going to happen 25 years from now when there are not enough young people in the workforce to support the older people that are going on Social Security? There are 5 people right now that work to support everybody on Social Security. By the year 2025, there'll be 2. This will bring about euthanasia, in my judgment, because the young people will simply say, we can't afford to keep these old people alive. So it's a very severe financial problem, as well as a moral problem. But I don't address it primarily from a financial end, but from a moral, from a scriptural, what God thinks of us. I appreciate that question. Any other? They have thought about it and talked about it, but that's it. That's the reason I'm pleading with all of you. Contact your state representatives and senators and tell them where you stand. Now, I don't mean you ought to threaten them, although I don't object to that. I don't mean threaten in any physical sense, but I don't mind telling a man, if you don't vote for life, I don't vote for you. We had a man in Georgia when we were fighting the Equal Rights Amendment, and I addressed him on radio, and I said, if you have convictions that demand that you support the ERA, that your conscience would hurt if you do not, then vote for it. But know that you don't represent the people in Whitfield and Murray counties. So we have convictions too, and the next time we'll send you home. And that's what we've got to do. Tennessee's not doing enough. I thought that they would jump on the bandwagon and be among the first to pass restrictive laws, but they have not. Churches of Christ could have an enormous impact on that if every one of us would call our senators, write them, make contact. We can't sit silently by. After all, silence can be sinful too. So we need to speak up and speak out. Any other question or comment? Yes. Right. No, I have not. But this passage that is mentioned talks about a mother who is pregnant. And two men get into a fight, and the woman expelled her baby. Now, if no damage is done, then of course the fine is considerably smaller. But if damage is done, if the mother is harmed or the child is harmed, then they have to pay an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That passage teaches that the baby in his mother's body is protected by the law of God. And incidentally, it's protected by the laws of the United States, at least in some cases. For example, if a family is in an automobile, all of them are killed except the baby in his mother's womb, and babies have been expelled and they've been delivered after the mother's died. That baby is an heir. And if there are two or three other heirs, he's a fellow heir. So the law does speak to it in the United States. But the Exodus passage, incidentally, there's a theologian, and I think his name is Waltke, an Old Testament scholar, who years ago said that does not protect the life of the baby. The baby is not considered human. But Dr. Waltke has changed his mind in view of passages like Jeremiah 1 and Psalm 139, which I mentioned. So no question in my mind that Exodus 21 protects both the mother and the baby. Any other comment or question? Yes. Yes. And of course the answer is, we really do not know, because the Word of God has not revealed. Of course, the separation of the twins is later, but I do not want to set an hour for ensoulment. As many of you probably know, Plato set 40 days for guys, and I believe 80 days for girls. That's when the soul enters. The Catholic Church took that position roughly for years, until about the time of